On RN and Radio Australia, this is David Rutledge.
And Meredith Lake.
Yes, and we're saying hello and welcome to a very special Good Friday edition of RN Breakfast. We'll be with you right up to 9 o'clock, and it's great to have your company. Yes, Easter is upon us once again. You probably feel like you've only just put away your Christmas decorations, but here we are. It's Good Friday. And time for religious reflections, if you happen to be that way inclined. That's part of what we're going to be talking about this morning, various perspectives on Good Friday and Easter. Not all of them devotional, as Easter means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And we'll be hearing from a thought-provoking selection of them this morning.
Yes, coming up between now and 9 o'clock, we're going to be exploring the problem of evil, hearing about the extraordinary life of a South Sudanese bishop and a former refugee, and asking what did Jesus look like? And we're talking about Christian anti-Semitism and much more, all coming up right here on RN Breakfast, so stay with us. Well, we're kicking off with some rather gorgeous music this morning. And you know, as composers get to the end of their lives, it's not uncommon for them to produce a magnum opus. And we see that with Orlando de Lassus, one of Renaissance Europe's most famous and influential musicians at the time of his death in 1594. The Tears of St. Peter was his last work, actually, a cycle of 20 madrigals and a motet for 7 voices. An incredible meditation on one of the most emotionally charged moments of the Passion narrative. After Jesus is arrested, Peter betrays him, denying 3 times that he even knows Jesus. And when he realizes what he's done, Luke's Gospel says, Peter goes outside and weeps bitterly. The Tears of St. Peter was performed recently at St. Peter's Cathedral in Adelaide, and Stephen Watkins went along on what turned out to be the evening of the sentencing of George Pell.
If it were so pungently poignant to others on this night after the sentencing that day of George Pell had been broadcast to the world, they didn't say. It was a beautiful night. Outside, the deep blue of fading light framed the amber-lit spires of a cathedral at a time of festival. Inside, the Church of St. Peter was soft-lit in shafts of purple and red to set the scene for the music. And what was the music? The Tears of St. Peter and the Miserere. Have mercy upon me, O God. The composer of the Tears of St. Peter was an old man. In the year he died, he wrote to the successor of St. Peter in Rome, saying, I send and dedicate to your holiness with the greatest reverence these Tears of St. Peter, which were composed some time ago by Luigi Tansillo and have been clothed in harmony by me for my personal devotion in my burdensome old age. The composer was Orlando de Lassus, Lasso, Lassus, and it suggested he had plenty to atone for in his burdensome old age. Throughout his 50s, he was still, let's call it frisky, setting a mass on the tune of a common ditty about the charm of young girls. But now he was depressed, spent, and preoccupied at 62 with his own mortality and haunted by his past. He had until now been working for the Duke of Bavaria, but was not wanted as before, and was regularly visited by the court physician for melancholia. Yes, Lassus had been writing more and more for the church in his later years, but the Tears of St. Peter were quite something else. For a start, was an architectural framework that was profoundly devotional and symbolic, a kind of magnum opus, a statement not so much to the world or to the Pope, but to God. He wrote for a choir of 7 voices, God's number, 7, and there were 21 movements, 3 by 7. 3 is the number for Holy Trinity, and 7 again the number for God. 7 is also the number of times Peter suggested to Christ that a sinful brother be forgiven, only to be rebuked by the answer that even 70 times seven acts of mercy would not suffice. Had the Pope in Rome noticed what these madrigals, these texts were, that Lassus was setting so beautifully to music? He knew them well. Luigi Tanzillo had carefully constructed these stanzas towards the end of his career too, after the Pope had censored some of his earlier work for its licentiousness. Yes, a penitent plea to the Holy Father for forgiveness before facing what was yet to come. There were 42 stanzas in that offering of penitence to the Pope. Now Lassus was presenting 20 of them in music. 20? Yes, he had something else up his sleeve for the 21st. Read consecutively, the stanzas present the stages of remorse experienced by Peter after his denial three times of knowing his friend and Lord. At first in these stanzas, he can't avoid Christ's eyes, which are like weapons that pierce the depths of his soul. And then, as if those eyes were mirrors, Peter sees in them his own unbearable transgression. Peter is torn asunder by this, and then imagines he can hear Christ accusing him of betrayal. The next 12 madrigals are a sequence of self-recrimination, and 14 to 20 bring to conclusion the desire of St. Peter to receive the punishment of death. The text reads, hoping to meet someone who would administer just punishment for his grievous sin. Since a fear of greater evil inhibits the bold hand, he wandered the shadows of the dark night, crying out when his agony thus moved him, and life, for which he had once cared so much, he now loathed more than anything else and feels pain because of it, since it caused his sin. He wants no more of it. So much then for the 20 madrigals of the penitent Luigi Tanzillo, the writer who presents this in his dotage to the Pope as an act of remorse and repentance. But back to the question, what is the 21st? That's the number that will bring to finality the seven-voice choir's presentation of the 3x7 construct of this masterpiece. By deliberate design, this one is outside the harmonic plan of the cycle. The first 20 madrigals are in a tonal arc through seven modes, musical modes, progressing from 1 to 7. But the final one, 21, is not even a madrigal, it's a motet. A madrigal is a common part song of the Renaissance without instruments. A motet is something else. It's sacred. And this now is not the old man talking. This is God. Tanzillo didn't write this. And its mode is a wandering one, a tonus peregrinus. Not an earthly one at all, but one that points towards heaven, from earthly things seen darkly to celestial things, where, as it says in the Holy Book, things are seen clearly, face to face. Did Lassus write these words himself? See, O man, what I have suffered for you. I cry out for you. I who am dying for you. See the agonies with which I am afflicted. See the nails with which I am pierced. There is no pain like that which torments me. And though the outward pain be great, the internal agony is graver still when I find you to be so ungrateful. Is that it? Yes, Lassus has not yet come to his end. He would die that year. Peter's Christ and his would soon also die, but rise again. For now the charge against St. Peter was palpable, painful. He too would die an awful death. Yet a line of successors would be built upon this otherwise rock on which Christ would build his church. The soft lights of St. Peter's church faded, and the audience slowly broke into applause. It was the day of sentencing for George Pell, and perhaps for the Church of St. Peter. The choir returned, sub-choir in the Lady Chapel. The companion piece to the Tears of St. Peter was by Allegri. Have mercy upon me, O God. For so long, music kept under lock and key, secret only to the papal chapel, in the home of the successor of St. Peter.
Stephen Watkins with that story from St. Peter's Cathedral in Adelaide. And of course, Stephen presents For the God Who Sings on ABC Classic. I'm David Rutledge here with Meredith Lake on this Good Friday morning, and you're listening to Breakfast on RN and Radio Australia. Meredith, are you a fan of musical theatre by any chance?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm a fan, but I did see the Book of Mormon recently, and I have to admit to laughing uproariously right through it. So I suppose that religion in the theatre, I'm always interested in that.
Yeah, I missed the Book of Mormon. I haven't caught up with it yet. I remember seeing, you know, Godspell and Jesus Christ Superstar in, I guess, would have been the 70s or maybe the early 80s. And, I like this next story because it's about a musical theatre performance, and the story itself would make a great musical. Right? I don't know if that makes any sense at all, so let's just roll the tape. From producer Alison Chan, this is the story of Angels, the musical.
Let me tell the tale of how it all began.
Angels tells the story of Sarah, the angel of light. And even though she's gifted with this amazing power to place the stars in the night sky and paint the sunrise and sunset, she thinks the real heroes are the angels that go down to Earth. So when it's announced one day that one angel is going to be chosen to bear a special honoured role, she sees this as the opportunity to prove herself that she can be just as good as those guardian angels. Jesus himself used parables to communicate to the masses. He told stories that were gripping, stories that raised questions, stories that would even puzzle people. But it's the questions that get planted in the listener that lead them towards an understanding of faith. So we don't want to answer the questions, we want to raise the questions.
And what are those questions?
What is your purpose in life? That is a question that if people ask sincerely, they can have an enormous positive impact on their life.
Marcus Chong was a director of a production company in Sydney. He teamed up with Ken Lai, his co-author, and they wrote Angels the Musical in 2006. Together, they started wondering about the stages of Broadway.
The astonishing thing about these 40 theatres in New York, if you can stage it there, you can then reach the entire world.
They decided to test out Angels in an off-Broadway production at the New York Musical Theatre Festival. The response was good enough for Marcus and his wife Clara to move to New York in 2006. Marcus then spent the next 2 years finding investors so that they could eventually make it to Broadway.
So we set up quite an ambitious production to mount the full show in September 2008 in Louisiana. We had raised millions of dollars, had hundreds of people working on the show, a cast of over 30 people, hundreds of thousand dollars worth of costumes, lights, sounds, the full production.
But something unexpected happened 4 weeks from opening night.
2008 was not a good year financially. We had money that was meant to be coming in to cover the operating expenses of the Louisiana production, but it never came in because of the financial situation in the US. And we were put into the most difficult decision that I've ever had to make in my life, which was to actually cancel the show just 4 weeks before the scheduled opening night. Our entire cast had just completed their first full run through of the show, and we had to tell them that this show was not going ahead and not to come into rehearsals the next day. And when I stood in front of the entire cast and crew, no words could actually come out of my mouth. It was really the shattering of a dream that had spent years in the making. You had people like the director, Rich Fowler, whose own father died in the middle of rehearsals, and he was unable to go back to Australia for the funeral. He Skyped into his own father's funeral because he was in the middle of rehearsals. People paid a high price to be part of this show because they believed in it, and they believed in the vision that this was going to have a powerful positive impact on people. So when it didn't happen, my first reaction was, what is going on?
After this, Marcus went looking for the $1 million they needed to save the show and keep the possibility of Broadway alive.
In those 2 years, it was almost as if all the wells had dried up financially, and after dozens and dozens of pitches and presentations and workshops and readings, not one single cent was raised. And that led to a point in 2010 when we had no option but to actually close down the company.
Can you tell me a little bit about the experience of pitching the show to investors and potential collaborators as an unknown Asian Australian in New York?
Well, first up, obviously it's weird. They look at the Chinese hair and then they hear the Australian voice, and some people literally stop me halfway through the meeting and go, wait a second, I just need to just call out how weird this is. And so there's this concept that, what are we even doing there? Like, these Americans have no idea that Chinese Australian musical producers exist.
Marcus then closed the company. They threw their costumes in the bin, declared the loss of all their assets, and let go of Angels. But years later, he decided to give it one more shot. He tried a different approach in 2016.
When we were doing things in 2006 to 2008, our eyes were so focused on the bright lights of Broadway, and it was almost as if that goal was overshadowing everything else. My approach now is to plant seeds.
With a new vision, they launched a musical album. Now, this was strange. Musical albums are normally recorded after they open on Broadway, but somehow they managed to convince enough people to give this a shot.
We started making this wish list of the top Broadway stars and started calling them up, and we got yeses after yeses after yeses for some of the top Broadway names: Laura Osnes, Josh Young, Robert Cuccioli, Alan H. Green, and we ended up with this dream team cast. Let me tell
the tale. There's a, you know, beautiful message of redemption and hope.
And that's what this show's all about. It's about finding your purpose and finding your friends and sticking with them no matter what.
I hope the message does really spread, because it's a story that needs to be told for sure.
Singing a song about strength and courage is a beautiful message to share at any point.
Part of this seed philosophy is to get schools, churches, community groups on a grassroots level performing the show. So in May 2017, St. Cyril's of Jerusalem in LA performed the show as a pilot production to see how would a group of 8 to 12-year-old kids do performing this show. Does the musical work in that environment? And the answer was a resounding yes.
My name is Helena, and I played the role of the Angel of Light, Sarah.
When I first heard about the Angels play, I was really excited.
Sarah is basically, at the beginning, she's this shy angel who wants to make a difference and do more for herself. Towards the end, she starts to become bolder, and she wants to save Tyriel, and it's this whole thing of journeying to Lucifer's domain.
Angels the Musical is about Sarah discovering her purpose. But it opens with the story of creation and ends with the birth of Jesus. This particular structure was inspired by the film Ben-Hur. The epic 1959 film was an adaptation of a book called Ben-Hur, A Tale of the Christ. The movie itself was an overwhelming success. It even scooped up 11 Academy Awards.
That was a little bit of the inspiration behind Angels, to take a structure a little bit like that, where we tell a completely fictional story and we're quite aware it's fictional, but we bookend it with a moment where it intersects with Jesus and the reality of who Jesus is.
So much more, the wind in my wings, the world at my feet.
In the story of Angels, the main character, Sarah, is someone who like really genuinely wants to make a positive difference. Yes. However, what happens during the course of the musical is that her well-intended actions have unintended and sometimes quite disastrous consequences. It seems that you've personally had to go through a very similar journey to Sarah.
It's a sharp observation that you have, and one that I've noticed too, that my life and our lives have somehow imitated the journey of the story we're trying to tell. And Sarah discovering her purpose but going through complete loss and having things go severely wrong because of her forays into pride and stepping into areas that she shouldn't have. In retrospect, I've seen and looked at some of the decisions I've made and some of the things that I've done and realized that, yeah, I've stepped into that area of doing things that I probably shouldn't have and had those moments where pride has taken over more than it should have. But hopefully, just like Sarah, I've learned to acknowledge those failures and come to terms with who I am and what I'm meant to do and do it in the best and most right way that I can.
In what ways has your own faith sustained or perhaps helped you during this quite eventful journey?
The one verse that keeps recurring is that all things will work for good. And that has sustained me.
Where does that come from?
It comes from Romans. The full verse says, all things work for the good of those who love God and are called according to his purpose. And every time something takes a turn for the unexpected or bad, I just hold on to that, all things will work for good. And they do.
Yet place your trust within my care, returned my faith in large amounts.
What I've learned is that every step and every day in a journey of faith is a surprise, and sometimes what happens is better and more amazing than we could actually ever imagine. So I treat each day with eyes open, ears open, looking forward for what there is to come.
Do you still want to one day open on Broadway?
I would love to.
Marcus Chong, the man behind Angels the Musical, ending that story from Alison Chan. And you're listening to Breakfast on RN and Radio Australia with me, Meredith Lake, and David Rutledge. And if you'd like to hear any of our stories again, you can always find us online via the RN website or podcast via the ABC Listen app. Coming up in the next half an hour, the problem of evil. But first, it's news time.